Aspen.com. And Mary is JelinasJames.com. And she spells her name GELINAS. JelinasJames.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. So I'm here with Alan Riskin and Mary Jelinas. And Alan, you were starting to talk about meeting Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut who actually walked on the moon.
That I was with a small group that we were researching collective wisdom at the time. And we met at the time on the campus, that IONS campus in Petaluma. And he wandered over in the evening to where we were. And one of our members asked him, you know, why he started the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And he, you know, he began on the moon, you know, that that after returning from the moon, he fell into a contemplative state and had a revelation of how deeply, deeply interconnected we all are. And it was a noetic experience. And that meeting really ignited in me wanting to know more about where this language of noetic came from. It shows up, once one starts looking, it shows up everywhere. It shows up in William James's work on mystic states. It shows up in Jacob Needleman's work on a bridge between the higher and lower dimensions of humanity. It shows up in Abraham Maslow's work as a meta-human phenomena. So it's there when one starts looking, but I was able to find a reference during the early Greek times in one of the Platonic dialogues. Socrates is explaining about consciousness. And he starts where Mary began. He starts with nature. He says, you know, everything in nature, fire, water, air, earth, are also in us. And at that time, 2,500 or so years ago, 2,300, they already understood that. So it wasn't hard for them to all shake their head and say, you know, you're right. We're made up of, you know, fire is digestion, air is the oxygen we breathe. They didn't have all the names for it, but they had the concept that nature and body were made of the same elements. And then Socrates says, and we're also made up of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. And he says of Nous, a self-regulating cosmic intelligence working for good ends.
Mary, you mentioned nature, and I'm thinking about nature, the invisible field of nature where everything is interconnected, you know, the trees, those mm-hmm. beautiful redwood trees you That's were right. talking about are all interconnected, their root systems and their branches, and they are all interdependent with one another. And I'm just thinking about that as when you talk about it's in our body, we're made of star stuff, as Brian Swim, the cosmologist, yes, would right. tell us.
What's lovely about that is we are so ingrained in thinking in terms of separation that we don't recognize the waters we swim in is one field. We're already connected. We don't have to work to create these connections. We have to remember that these connections are there underneath the ground, like you said, in the mycelium networks, in the quantum field that is alive with forces that are operating. And the ability to slow down enough to begin to see that those connections between us can arise if we're willing to be vulnerable enough to open to each other, to discover that we're humans facing similar kinds of suffering, similar kinds of challenges, maybe in all different dress. But underneath it all, there's an orientation that we live, we grow old, we die, and that orients us to care for each other as well.
If we realize this field and understand it and know it in our body, we won't feel so alone. Is
exactly.
that what I'm getting?
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I think the field of quantum physics, as they learn more and more, is pointing to how everything is relational, way down to the neurons in our brains and in our bellies and around our hearts, that everything is relational. It's all, you know, and Carlo Rovelli, who's a beautiful writer who's an Italian physicist, speaks about this, of how everything is relational, both to the micro all the way to the macro. And I think what both of you are saying is it's really becoming consciously aware of that. And for me, and I think this might be true for universally, is where we experience that is in our bodies when we pay attention. And what's interesting to me is the brain moves a lot faster than our bodies do. So it's allowing the wisdom of our bodies to emerge and not go into the analytic piece that you mentioned earlier of how our brains go into analysis and labeling. And so to stay with the direct experience of sensation and emotion. And what Alan and I talk about is kind of an integrative knowing. And it's in that integrative knowing from our minds and our bodies and our hearts that we can actually experience that interrelationship, those interconnections, those interdependencies.
You talk about the common characteristics of the fields. And one of those characteristics that really popped out at me was valency. And it's about the power of attraction. Mm. It's about love. I mean, isn't that the power of attraction is about love?
Yeah.
Can you say something about that characteristic in our fields?
Yes. Mary, you want to go first?
No, I was going to say you go first.
Okay, you go first.
You go first. No.
This is how
you...
Mary and I talk all the time. You know, it's like, you want to say... I want to start again with the preamble, which is the number of people who feel isolated. And it is an epidemic of loneliness. Mm-hmm. And all of the clinical issues that come with loneliness, whether it's eating disorders, whether it's obsession with drugs. I mean, loneliness is a source from which so many psychological and physical ailments come. And it's sort of the soft, tender part of fields, that to be able to step out of the paradigm we're separate and realize the implications of being already connected. It's frightening in some ways, because as you said earlier about the media asking about who's in charge, almost everything around us continues to divide us and polarize, right, which reinforces the idea we're separate. And I don't think like those people. And so we're bombarded in every possible way with the restatement that we're separate and insignificant. And so the soft underbelly of this is to, in some ways, allow the grief to come forward of what it feels like to feel such aloneness. And then out of that, begin to realize we have some agency. We have the ability and are affecting others in the same field that's separating us. We can begin to reach out in some small way, whether it's smiling people on the street, you know, whether it's engaging someone in small conversation, whether it's calling up a friend and saying that you just want to talk. But we have agency without suggesting that it will be easy, because the reinforcement to stay separate is mm-hmm. so powerful. It suggests, Justine, also that the stories we have about ourselves are not the whole story. You know, Mary and I are expansive introverts. We're quite introverted. But in no way does it imply that we can't connect with people. So the story we have about ourselves needs to be looked at.
Exactly.
Yeah, if I could add one piece here. The need to belong, the need to connect with other human beings is essential to our sense of safety. I mean, that's how the brain evolved. To keep us alive, And the mammalian brain in particular evolved through being connecting with other, I mean, that's how safety was created. And so even though we might not now be being attacked by lions, tigers, or bears, we do have psychological threats of that isolation that we're talking about. And so the simple gestures of you standing on a line in a grocery store and just making eye contact and smiling, it shifts not only something inside us, in the other person, and in the space around us. That's an important part of it, is it also shifts in the social field. So it shifts the personal fields. It also shifts the social field, meaning making them more salubrious, healthier, more connective. And it doesn't take a lot. It can be one simple, and sometimes when we're in situations where we sense that someone, might be getting angry or they're fearful or whatever, or they're yelling at us for some reason or whatever, there's so much anger around and fear around right now. That sometimes we don't even have to do anything other than manage our internal state and calm it down, because we are so connected with one another. Managing our internal state can shift not only ourselves but the person near us, and we don't even have to say anything.
Exactly. I want to go back to murmuration. I want to ask you. This summer, there was a No Kings protest where 7 million people spontaneously showed up in small towns and big towns all over the place. And I'm wondering, is that a social murmuration?
That's a nice question. I think so. What do you think, Alan?
Well, I could describe it from the perspective of people who've been in during that day. And one person described it as just a delight, that, and there was a friendliness, and it was not punctuated by anger. It was a really joyful expression of what is we want for ourselves, all of us. In another area, it was described as more transactional. People showed up, but they were sort of checking their phones and talking about what they were going to do over the weekend. And she didn't feel any of that energy. And she actually said, because we're all in a room, she said, I wish I had come to your murmuration.
I was in a small town. I went to a small town, and I just found it delightful. I met people, and they weren't of the same political persuasion as me. It was obvious that we had different politics in mind, but we had a common cause that just was delightful.
I love what you're saying, because one of the folks that we talk about in our book did computer modeling for murmurations. And one of the qualities he found is that each bird stayed in relationship to the other birds around them. And that's what you're talking about with a social murmuration at those marches. Just what you're saying, even though you might have had different political views, you were still in connection and relationship to one another, which I think is part of a social murmuration.
Can I ask you about synchronicity? Does it have anything to do with field theory, so to speak?
Shall I start this one?
A long pause.
Yeah, it's things that happen in combination with one another that are meaningful. It's not just a chaos. There are things that in relationship to one another that, I'm thinking about someone and all of a sudden they call me, I'm thinking about a group of people and all of a sudden they want to talk. It's so interesting, that synchronicity. And for me, I think it has to do with both the, the coherence, maybe a similar vibration inside me and in the space around me can draw things to me that bring up synchronous things that are meaningful. What would you add to that? Because that's your...
Tell the story, Mary, of Eddie, which is in our book, of your experience with Eddie, and then I'll talk about how I came to understand synchronicity as an expression of a field. So,
oh, okay.
ETTY, Eddie.
So Eddie Hillesum, as you may know, was a victim of the Holocaust, and she kept a diary during that time, and she was killed in her late 20s. Long story short, there was one day after Alan and I had been speaking that I just felt so, God, I can even feel my heart racing as I talk about this, that I felt so desirous of wanting to find language for what we were talking about that would be accessible to people. So I wandered around my house, which is filled with books, and somehow I landed on this bookshelf and my hand landed on the book by Eddie Hillesum. And I opened it because I first read it when it came out in 1980. And so she was talking about her desire to capture in language what she was experiencing as she was hiding from the Gestapo. And it spoke to me so deeply. So how did that happen? How did I go to that bookshelf? How did my hand land on that book? I don't know. I just know that I'm really grateful for it.
And so we can almost talk about connections that are almost magnetic in nature. They come together. You know, in this case, it was very moving because Mary communicated soon after about specific passages she found that spoke to her desire and our desire to somehow transcend language. Language was getting in the way of what we wanted to say, and that's just what she was talking about. Has she struggled with finding language that could come close to what her actual experience is that she wanted to express? And the magnetic quality, I'll kind of give another story. Jung is the person who's credited with naming it synchronicity. And so I became very interested, is how the hell did he do that? How did he go from being a clinician to describing synchronicity? And his first experience of finding language was from a friend who sent him an ancient Taoist text. And he saw in this text references to things magnetizing together that had no causal explanation. And he felt, this is it. This is what I'm trying to find. But how do I explain it within a Western context? And literally, while he's musing on this, knocking at his door is the quantum physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who's come for a totally separate reason. He's come because he was in Zurich, he was having emotional difficulties, he had heard about this guy Jung, he wanted to ask for consultation. And Jung ended up referring him to another analyst, but staying in contact with him for decades, and letters going back and forth. And they finally come up with the field expression of synchronicity, which changes our orientation to causality. Causality is a concept that things happen because something happened before it. And synchronicity is that there's connectivity through meaning that doesn't require a sequential linear process.
I just love that. I love that. And I need to ask you also, if you can help us, how can we develop the capacity for actually noticing fields?
Well, I would say any somatic work, you know, my particular process has been through the work of Moshe Feldenkrais, learning Feldenkrais work, which, you know, which is awareness through movement. So it's awareness. So others may have very different perspectives. But for me, it's about listening, you know, listening inside to body sensations and noticing those and practicing. Because many people, I've been working this for decades now, so it's more familiar to me. But I would say, you know, just beginning with noticing your heart rate, noticing your breath, and doing that in calm waters, when you're by yourself or when you're with friends, versus doing it when things are heated up, because it's very hard to access that awareness when you're triggered, when you're triggered emotionally.
Exactly. And I'm thinking also one of the big ones for us, I think, is suspension of certainty.
Yes.
You know, yes. Yes. Being curious,
yes.
Remaining in that field of curiosity. We all get so certain that we know the answer. So any thoughts on that?
Well, Justine, you know my brand of humor. So to your question of how do we pay attention is to listen less to the advice of others. and by that, I mean that we begin to get comfortable with the sage within ourselves. And how does one notice that? And then Mary is beginning to sort of paint that picture. You notice more when you do less. When you quiet the mind, whether it's in silence 5 minutes a day, whether it's walking in nature, in groups, it's noticing how quickly we will react.
Yes.
And consciously recognizing the reaction, but then slowing it down. In the Jewish tradition, there's a concept of ayin tova. It means the good eye. And what it suggests is just this idea that we be aware and limit our immediate judgments of others. And we try to look upon others for their best self. We try to look upon others as having the same desires to be loved, to love others.
Yeah, and I just want to go back to what you said, Justine, about certainty is I think perceiving fields invites us. In fact, it may demand that we get more comfortable in the unknown. Mm. You know, because we don't necessarily know at first what's going on inside me, what's going on inside around me, what's going on in the people around me. And as I said, the brain works so much faster than the body. So to, you know, notice when I'm going into judgment of other people or to notice when I'm going into judgment of myself, just notice it. Create some space around it and just sit there, you know, be with not knowing, because something will emerge in that space always.
And being, I think, aware that there are diverse perspectives and mine isn't the only one and maybe mine isn't the most important one. So, and right. even if we enter a field that feels like there's conflict, Not to withdraw from that. I think you talk about that.
And I think this is the deeper work you're pointing to.
That,
you know, as Mary is pointing out, the brain will move towards certainty because it's physically and emotionally and psychologically comforting. Yeah. So there's no guesswork about why we move in that direction. It's the counter move. It's the realizing that certainty is as much an illusion as what we want to believe or what we don't believe. There is no neutral place to observe things so that, oh, I'm just being objective. You know, it doesn't work like that. And so it's a revelation to realize I can't be objective. Where whatever comes from me comes from a personal field that has been constructed, much of which I don't even know about. So how can I be certain? That doesn't mean I can't have values. It doesn't mean I can't be leaning into caring for others. It just means that certainty isn't necessary to do that.
When you say caring for others, there are those who believe that caring is a finite attribute.
And you
all say no, it's caring is a huge field that we all can plug into, and it goes to that idea of tikkun olam, I guess.
Yes.
So
yes.
any thoughts on that? As we,
well, I guess if there's one, you know, there are many purposes that I think Alan and I tried to meet in writing this book. If I were to go to the essential purpose, it would be to create caring fields you know, within and among us. That to me is, yeah, it's the deeper practice that Alan, both you are pointing to, expanding our ability to have awareness outside ourselves and have caring in that space around us. Not just the people immediately around me, but the people in Sudan right now. You know, I mean, we could brainstorm a list of around the world, Gaza, where people and children and mothers are dying and suffering. Not to say that men are too, but it's to create a more caring and expanding our ability to create a caring field. I would say it that way.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to thank you both for being with us today. And I want to remind our listeners, I've been here with Dr. Alan Briskin and Dr. Mary V. Janinas. And we are talking about the book that they have co-authored, Space is Not Empty, How Hidden Fields Are Shaping Your Life and Our World. And if you want to know more about their work, you can go to, and for Alan, alanbriskin.com, alanbriskin.com. Or for Mary, it would be galenasjames.com. And she spells her name G-E-L-I-N-A-S, galenasjames.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms, and I thank you for listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3852.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. It keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.